Hello, and welcome to the fourth reading of Not So Fast by Tommy Maxwell with Rod Butler. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Tommy Maxwell has just concluded a tremendously successful college football career at Texas A&M. He got married. He and his wife have gone into pro football as husband and wife. And that's where we continue with Not So Fast. Super Bowl V is the chapter heading. That offseason, God used Bailey and Joyce Stone to open up a whole new world for Janice and me. We also became close friends with Sam and Janice Wood as neighbors in the same condos. Sam worked as a young pharmacist, while his wife Janice was a stay-at-home mom. All I can remember is fun and laughter in our relationship. We practically spent every day together. And my country girl bride, who admits she kind of likes the smell of horses, loved petting the horses in a field right behind our condo. Those horses were always happy to see us when we brought handfuls of carrots and apples. That seemed like a quick off-season after my second year of pro football, filled with four warm memories for me: the birth of our daughter, Leslie, becoming close with Bailey and Joyce, and Janice and Sam, Janice and the horses, and finally, my baptism. I have one other great memory, riding in a 1930 Ford Model A we called the Doozy. It was a lifesaver for us because Leslie had some bad colic episodes, lots of crying, and the only thing that seemed to help her was our chuggity-chug rides in the Doozy. I guess the sound and maybe the vibration of the car knocked her out quickly. And since there was always a kind of warm, old-time car smell, we wondered if that helped her, too. We used to laugh about it as an afterthought. Leslie would sleep most of the way through all the trips we made. The big one, Super Bowl V. One of the more memorable experiences in my life, in my entire football career, came on January 17, 1971. I was with the Baltimore Colts when we played the Dallas Cowboys in Super Bowl V. This marked the first Super Bowl since the AFL-NFL merger. The game started at 2 o'clock p.m. under the hot Miami sun. The heat was made worse by this being the very first Super Bowl ever played on an artificial surface. The start time was early. In fact, this was the first Super Bowl played before noon in the Pacific time zone. Despite the early start time, 46.1 million people still tuned in to watch what would later be called the Blunder Bowl. The two teams combined for a total of 11 turnovers in this historical game that still stands as the only Super Bowl where a member of the losing team won the MVP. And a defensive MVP at that. The award went to Chuck Howley of the Cowboys. I remember well a team meeting about halfway through the season before the Super Bowl. We were not sure what to think, as the coaches were not invited to this one. We hadn't been playing too well, and the older players were still blaming and pointing fingers for the Colts' loss to the Jets in Super Bowl III in 1969. Despite the fact that the Jets were picked to lose by about 20 points, Joe Namath had gone public that the Jets would beat the Colts and then shock the world by doing that very thing. Really, a large number of Colt players carried bad feelings toward Super Bowl III. Now, the night before the big game, they called us to meet right after dinner to address the importance of Super Bowl V. In that same room, they had makeshift stadium-style seating for the players. We found our places on the seats. The chatter calmed down, and the meeting began. Some of the retiring older players looked at the younger players, telling them this was their last chance to win the big one. They all had something to say, venting strong feelings about how the Colts screwed up Super Bowl III. Veteran linebacker Mike Curtis stood up at one point and let it be known, "I'm going to cut right to the chase here, fellas. If we lose, I'm going to kick every single one of your butts." That was his talk, and we knew he might very well do just that. Unitas stands up. The last man to stand up and talk was the great Johnny Unitas. He had been injured earlier in the year and had very little playing time for a quarterback of his caliber. But he was the unquestioned leader of our team. He was the Arnold Palmer of football at that time. He stood quietly before the team for an almost awkward amount of time, looking every player directly in the eyes. Everyone sat stone still and dead silent. Our leader was about to speak, and everyone was glued to him, waiting. Nobody dared say a word. Finally, he broke the silence. If I hear one word from anyone about that Super Bowl we lost against the Jets, or if you talk about what another player should have done, I'm going to personally kick you off this team. I don't care where we are, at a restaurant, in the locker room, on the field, I'm going to personally kick you off this team. He meant it. He'd had it with all the negative talk and focus on the past. Unitas continued, "Fellas, we've been griping and complaining ever since we lost that Super Bowl. But this is what we're going to do. We're going to start encouraging one another, building one another up, doing everything we can to make each member of this team a better player. And if we do that, we will win the Super Bowl. You understand?" After these words, he turned around and walked right out of the room. Our captain's words spoke louder than any pep talk we had ever had. We all remained seated in the awkward moment that followed. Nobody knew what to do. Eventually, some of the older players led us out, and we heard some of them saying, "I've never heard Johnny give a talk about anything." He was a quiet leader. When I got back to the hotel room, Rick Volk was jumping from his bed to my bed. I asked, "What are you doing?" Without stopping his motion, he just started yelling, "You're going to win the Super Bowl." And that was how I felt, too. Johnny had said it, and he was the man. We had hope again. O'Brien's big kick. Game day. Super Bowl V. Guess I'll skip the play-by-play and get to the amazing part. With a little over a minute left in the game, tied 13-13, rookie Colt kicker Jim O'Brien kicked off, and the ball went into the end zone. The Cowboys took it on the 20-yard line. They started their march down the field. 10 yards, 12 yards, 8 yards. They were on the 50-yard line with 15 seconds on the clock. It was second down and long when Craig Morton rolled right and threw the ball to Dan Reeves, who tipped it up. Mike Curtis, our all-pro middle linebacker, made a diving interception. And since Mike was a fullback in college, I guess he thought he could run it back for a TD. He was trying to bring back the old moves, but they were just not there. He forgot he was now a linebacker. With the clock ticking down, 15 seconds, 12 seconds, we were all screaming, "Hit down, Mike! Hit down!" We wanted a chance at a field goal. And thankfully, the Cowboys took him down on the 32-yard line with 8 seconds left on the clock. Now, here's where it gets good. You will have to tune into the TV when they replay the highlights of past Super Bowls. Then you can give your friends some commentary on Jim O'Brien's big kick, because this is how it happened. Sam Haverlack and I were friends with Jim, and we thought we should go up and say something to him. He was a young player like Sam and me. Only a few youngins like us were on the old Baltimore Colts team, and we wanted to encourage Jim. Not wise. Best to leave your kicker alone at times like that. Anyway, we meandered up to Jim and said, "How you doing, Jim?" He looked at us with that look. "Well, stupid, how do you think I'm doing?" he said, then continued, "Not so good. You don't understand the pressure, man." Uh-oh, dumb idea, I thought. Now here comes the funny part. Billy Ray Smith, a tough, older defensive player for the Colts, came slowly walking toward us. We were all afraid of Billy Ray since we had heard stories of his ferocious boxing days and how he leveled a guy in Dallas after a mildly offensive exchange. Let me digress on that encounter so you can know Billy better. Some guy on the freeway in Dallas had flipped Billy Ray off, and Billy Ray signaled for him to pull over. The stupid guy pulled over. Well, as the story goes, they met outside a hotel right off Central Expressway. Then, boom, Billy Ray gut-punched him before he knew what happened. The guy went down, gasping for air. Anyway, Billy Ray called the police and stayed there until they came. He could be nice like that to his victims. Now to continue. On this hot day in Miami, Billy Ray came walking toward Jim, Sam, and myself with a very serious and tired look on his face. Sam and I froze in place. Billy Ray grabbed Jim O'Brien by his shoulder pads, put his face mask right on Jim's and said, "Son, there's millions of bucks riding on this kick. Now you go make it." Billy gave Jim a big shove, and the young player stumbled forward, staggering onto the field. Jim got his footing, then turned around and chuckled. There we were, witnessing the old NFL in action without realizing it. Folks, you would never see anything like that today. Well, the Cowboys called timeout to give Jim some time to think about his chance to win the Super Bowl. But what they didn't know was that Jim was already locked in. He could have waited all day because his mind was made up. Make it or face Billy Ray. Easy choice. Jim kicked it so perfectly, it could have been a 60-yard field goal. He put it right through the middle. And here's the best part. Sam Haverlack came up to me after all the celebration and said, "Hey, Tommy, I didn't realize that Billy Ray was such a great psychologist." I will always remember that line. Almost 50 years later, I still laugh when I do. Scan this QR code for Tommy's sports videos and interviews. Chapter 9, Oakland Raider, number 42. Madden calls. The joy of winning the Super Bowl with the Colts was short-lived. A few months after the game, Janice and I were staying with her folks in Brady, Texas. Her mom tapped on the door of our room about midnight and said that there was a Mr. John Madden on the phone. Barely awake, wondering who the heck John Madden was, I picked up the phone to hear a voice that would become very familiar over the next few years. Oakland Raiders coach John Madden said, "Tommy, we're excited to have you as part of our organization." I didn't know what to say. Another awkward silence. Coach Madden continued, "Tommy, have the Colts not contacted you about our trade?" "No, sir," I mumbled. Coach Madden said a few choice words and then told me he was glad I was a Raider and that he would have the Colts contact me first thing. To this day, I still don't know how the Raiders found me in Brady, but as a fan of Raider history, I know they could always find a way. I was surprised, to say the least, as I still considered myself a Colt. I mean, we had just won the Super Bowl title, the first in the modern era with the merger of two major American football leagues, the NFL and the AFL. As I climbed in bed staring at the ceiling, I remember thinking, "Well, if you're going to be traded, it's nice to be traded to another team who may also reach the Super Bowl." The notorious Raiders. I had to process it. The year was 1971, and I'd just been traded to the notorious Oakland Raiders, a team known for being the bad boys of pro football, a team that would, in the upcoming years, lead me all the way to growing sideburns. I learned pretty quickly that the team in Oakland was a family that lived by the motto, "Once a Raider, always a Raider." To this day, I still get gifts and birthday cards from the Raiders organization. Back then, at the end of training camp, they had a kind of bowling tournament for those who made the 40-man squad, team roster. I remember a manager coming up to me toward the end of training camp, my first year with the Raiders, and announcing that I was Billy Bob's, well-known Raider, not his real name, partner in this bowling tournament. He then told me to go to this local bar for the tournament. A bar for bowling? Interesting. Well, when I walked in, the place was hopping. Lots of excitement in the air. Then I saw what kind of bowling tournament this was. Remember the arcade-style bowling games? You stood at the miniature alley, about 10 feet long by 2 feet wide, which was raised up on four legs, and you pushed a small puck to hit the automated pins at the far end. When you hit the pins, they'd flip up into the machine. That kind of bowling. Billy Bob came up and leaned on me. With somewhat slurred, happy-hour language, he said, "Tommy," that's me, Tommy, "I've been a Raider for 10 years and have never won this tournament. I don't bowl that well, and you have to come through, man. You got to carry us, man. You can do this, man." I looked at him and said, "I have never done this before, Billy Bob, but I'll give it a try." Maybe since I was the only sober one in the whole bar, I started rolling strikes. Honestly, I think the machine was broken. Anyway, we won the tournament, and Billy Bob was the happiest man I have ever seen in my life. That seemed very strange at the time, but not so strange as you get to know the Raiders, back then anyway. He actually had tears in his eyes. Now, this is the part you will not believe, but it gives you a little insight into a rather unique football team. Before I knew it, big hands under my legs carried me and Billy Bob around the bar. Champagne corks popped and champagne sprayed. Billy Bob and I were soaked. Very different from the Super Bowl victory I had celebrated just 6 months prior. Janice still remembers me calling her that night and saying, "I'm not sure what planet I've landed on, but it's in the Raider galaxy for sure." Yeah, this was a different brand of football than I was used to, but you know what? It was fun. The club president and part owner was Al Davis. What a character, but a fun and very smart character. He knew the business side and had a nose for talent, as well as understood the strategy of the game. That made him a very interesting man, since he was not an athlete and never part of any athletic team. If you asked Al how he knew something, he would always say, "I know everything." And I think he did. I used to laugh at that statement, yet at a reunion dinner in honor of George Blanda, who had passed away, Al gave a fascinating history of AFL football, which he helped start. It should have been recorded. That would have been the best TV football special ever. And it all happened under the old Raider Stadium. They had set up tables with about 8 former players around each table. What an evening. Blanda and Madden. My first meeting with Raider legend George Blanda was typical Blanda. It had roots going back to my baby Oiler days, when I met many players, one being Oakland Raider legend George Blanda, who went on to play until he was 48 years old. As an adult, at my first Raider workout, I went up and introduced myself to George. I said, "You may not remember me, but when I was a baby Oiler, 13 years old, I met you. We played an inter-squad game at halftime during an Oiler game. You shook the team's hands after our performance." He looked at me for a second and said, "I knew if I stayed around this game long enough, one of you little would get old enough to play with me." Typical Blanda. George used to enjoy talking about his Houston Oiler heydays, and I would egg him on since I asked a lot of questions about players and games. George Blanda and John Madden were really the faces of the franchise at that time, and both had unique personalities. They and Al Davis gave the Raiders their well-earned reputation. Coach Madden was a different kind of coach. He had an easy smile, a refreshing honesty, and a creativity that you don't see in many coaches. None of us were surprised to see what a great commentator Coach Madden later became on TV. He made it personal with individual players and offered insights not only into their skills, but also into their personalities. He actually enjoyed the different personalities of each player as much as their football ability. We wouldn't just say, "Nice block," as a normal TV commentator might say when describing a certain play. He would talk about the quirks of the player and describe why it was a nice block. He truly loved the game of football and liked to hang out with the players, especially offensive linemen, since that was his old position. Now, Coach Madden liked psychology. I heard that was his major in college. I remember a couple of funny times when he would bring out his psychology insights to enlighten us. One time, we played the Cowboys in a preseason game in Dallas. It was the first time we had played in their new stadium, which had synthetic turf. It was a thin, rug-like material called tartan turf, laid over an asphalt surface. Very hard. The players all talked about the hard field, stepping on it, pressing it with their fingers. Coach Madden walked up and delivered a typical Madden psychology lecture. He said, "What do you guys think about this turf?" One of the players said what we were all thinking. "Coach, this stuff is hard. I feel like we're playing on cement." Then Coach Madden jumped on that. "You just think it's hard. It's not really hard." Okay, we all knew that a psychology lesson was coming. Coach Madden loved these get-into-your-head moments. "Listen, guys, the cushioning under this material is like the cushioning on the dashboard of a car. When you feel the dashboard of a car, it feels hard, right? But if you have an accident and slam into the dashboard, it gives with you, right? That's what happens when you run or fall on this field." One of the players sarcastically said, "Wow, coach, that was fascinating. Why don't you run and take a jump in the air and land your body on this stuff to show us how it gives with you?" Madden actually liked that kind of kidding. As I recall, one of the players giggled, and Madden had to smile too. I think he realized that it was a strange conversation before a football game, but that's what made Coach Madden kind of lovable. He was not the grim-faced, no-nonsense coaches you may have had. Madden always wanted to pass along some new revelation. He was always philosophizing because everything was always about the mind and positive thinking. And get this, he wanted us to call him John, not Coach. My friend Monty Johnson has a great Madden story. Monty, a second-round draft pick from Nebraska, was selected as a middle linebacker. I was fortunate to play for John Madden, Monty told me. He was as much a teacher about life as a great football coach. One year, I was injured in a game against the Broncos, and it didn't look like I'd be able to play the next week. Sure enough, in the locker room, I overheard teammates saying Ted would start for me. I was not happy. In his office, John confirmed it. Ted was starting for me. In a rage, I stood up, put away the chair, and stormed out. John, in a calm voice, said, "Monty, get back in here, and if you don't, it's going to cost you $5,000 for every minute you don't." I walked back in, at the chair, and sat down. He asked if I had a quarter. I did. He asked me to hold it up and said, "What do you see?" I described my side of the quarter. He said that's not what he saw on his side. Then I realized this wasn't about quarters. It was about how you look at life. John's point was that there are two sides to every situation. When you learn to see things from another person's point of view, it helps you as a leader and helps you not make a fool of yourself. The end of the story? Ted did start for me, but then John put me back in. "I told Ted he was going to start for you," Madden later said, "not play the whole game." I can't look at a quarter without thinking of that life lesson from John Madden. Monty went on to become a successful businessman and a Bible study fellowship leader in Atlanta, Georgia. Here's another Coach Madden story. On an unusually hot and humid day in Oakland during practice, Coach Madden heard some of the players complaining about the heat. Of course, being a Houston, Texas boy, I knew hot and humid, and it was not that bad. Of course, Madden being Madden, a fix-all psychology lecture was on the way. He gathered us together. "Boys, it is not that hot. You're used to a cooler climate in California. You just have to tell your brain that it's not that hot. Just keep saying to yourself, 'Feels cool today. It sure feels cool.' And you'll forget about the temperature. Stop talking about it being hot." Well, he was lecturing to players decked out in complete uniforms, and he had on a Raiders t-shirt and Bermuda shorts. About halfway through practice, Coach Madden became dizzy, took a knee, and the trainer ran in his direction with some ice. Coach Madden was a big man. We were concerned, but some of the players were kidding with each other, saying, "It's not that hot," as they saw the trainer putting ice on Coach Madden. As he became more conscious, we could see that smile come across his face. Coach Madden could laugh at himself, and he did. He looked up at the players and said, "Well, maybe it is hot. Practice is over." I miss Coach Madden. Chapter 10, Not So Fast, The Nickname. Most of the players had a nickname. You knew you had arrived if you had a nickname. I didn't have one. Not yet. Fridays were called easy days because it was mostly film watching and a short review on the field. At one point during practice, Coach Madden would stand on the sideline and call out special teams so each man knew his position: kickoff team, field goal team, punt team, etc. Eventually, it was time for the onside kickoff return team to hit the field, and I was part of it. In fact, I had a somewhat prestigious position since I was in the middle of the left side where the right-footed kickers would try to send a wobbly kick toward you. You were thought to have good hands if you were put on the front line of an onside kickoff return team. Well, for two games in a row, I had onside kicks come right to me. You hardly ever see onside kicks, so that was rare. The first game, I bobbled the kick and it went out of bounds. The second one in the next game, I bobbled, but also recovered. The next Friday practice, after that second bobble, Coach Madden called for the onside kickoff return team to come to the practice field. As usual, I ran to my position. You know, the position I thought I deserved. When I lined up, Coach Madden stood close to me and called out, "Maxwell, That caught my attention. We're putting Bob at your position. That was embarrassing. I wanted to protest, or at least ask if we could talk about it, but in pro ball, your feelings don't really matter. Performance matters. After two bobbles, coach wanted a reliable, experienced player there. Then the perennial all-pro guard, Gene Upshaw, took the opportunity to holler out, loud and clear, for everyone to hear it, "Not so fast, Maxwell." Well, you already know the rest of the story. Yep, "Not so fast" became yours truly. Not the nickname I would have picked, but I'm not in control of things, am I? Upshaw had noticed that I trotted over to the position I thought was mine. But things change. Players rotate. He'd probably seen that kind of thing before. I'm sure I looked like a sorry pup, walking away from my place on a special team. And, fortunately, or maybe unfortunately, the name stuck. In fact, about 6 years ago, a friend of mine ran into Phil Villapiano, great linebacker for Oakland, nicknamed Foo, and asked him if he knew me. Phil smiled and said, "Sure, I know old Not So Fast." As time has moved on, I actually enjoy telling the story behind the nickname. So, the not-so-fast story continued to spread. To honor George after his passing, the Raiders family contacted all the former Raiders who had played with George Blanda to attend a reunion in Oakland. They paid for everything. Al Davis loved George, and George won many a game for the Raiders as a field goal kicker, very unusual for a quarterback. What a special reunion. It brought back so many memories. At a reception in the hotel, many past and present Raiders came together. An active Raider came up to me and said, "So, you're not so fast. I didn't think I'd get a chance to meet you." He went on, "We had a get-together party not too long ago and voted for the best nicknames of all time." He looked at me and smiled. "Did you know that you were the number one pick?" I thanked him and later got to thinking, I never was a starter with the Raiders. I was always frustrated and half mad about that, but some of my best stories have come from being on that team. I wish I could have enjoyed myself more, because it was a rare group of fun guys and great football players. We should have won the Super Bowl every year I was there, but we just couldn't get there, even though we were always in the playoffs. Not long ago, I complained to a friend about how I wish I'd been a starter for the Raiders, even though I was a fifth defensive back and came in frequently on third and long passing downs. We would man-to-man all the potential receivers. My friend did a little research and said, "Tommy, did you know that all the defensive backs from your days with the Raiders are now all pro, including two who are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame?" I did get to be the up back on punt returns. I would position about 10 yards in front of George Atkinson and catch the shorter punts. George was a good return man, and he would call out, "You got it, Maxwell," on shorter punts. So I mostly fair caught the shorter, more difficult punts. The Raiders were known to play, well, a little more than just aggressively. Some would say they played dirty. I wasn't really accepted until a couple of incidences. Then, unknowingly, a chance came to become a truly accepted Raider. We were playing the Los Angeles Rams. I had to come across the line to turn back a sweep play. In those situations, you will always have a 275-pound pulling guard barreling towards you with a smile on his face. I'm not kidding. They were always smiling. Very intimidating. You have to either go into a self-defense mode and stand your ground, or turn and start running away, a temptation, which would look somewhat cowardly. It all happened very quickly, but I remember doing the only thing that could possibly stop this killer's attack on my poor body. I popped his helmet with the palm of my hand, and he went down like a 100-pound bag of corn and didn't even move for a good 5 minutes. I never knew what happened since I tried to make a play on the runner. When I came to the huddle after the play was over, all the secondary players were excitedly saying, "Maxwell, you killed that boy over there. You killed him, man." I said, "You're crazy." They persisted. "Look at him, Maxwell. He's just laying there, man. He's dead. I'm telling you, he's dead." I kept looking over, and he just kept laying there. I began to worry. Finally, LA's trainer and crew helped lift him up, and he staggered off the field. Well, I became a true Raider that night, fully accepted as one of the Raider bad boys. The most frustrating year was when we lost the AFC Division playoff against the Pittsburgh Steelers in the famous Immaculate Reception game. Google it for more info. I'll just say this. No one said a word on the plane ride all the way home. Back home, Houston Oilers. My career came full circle in 1974 when I signed with the Houston Oilers. I started as a kilt baby Oiler and would end my career playing in my hometown for the professional Oilers. I was with the Oilers for one season when I started having neck pain. A team doctor ran tests, and the result was not good. More on that later. By far the best memory from that time is my relationship with Oil Andrew Phillips Jr., football player, United States Marine, executive, and coach. Known to pretty much everybody as Bum Phillips. Later in life, as executive director of Coaches Outreach, CO, I called Coach Phillips to ask him if he would speak for our annual CO dinner. I was surprised that he answered the phone at his home in Texas. I briefly told him about our ministry to coaches. He said, "Let me get Debbie on the phone. She loves Bible studies." Bum's wife, Debbie, came to the phone, and I described our ministry to her. She listened politely to my description of Coach's outreach and then shared how Coach Phillips recently had heart bypass surgery and she was trying to keep him rested. Bum was still on the phone and said, "Debbie?" She responded, "Yes, Bum." "I'm not dead yet," he boomed. "I'd like to go talk for that banquet." She responded, "Okay, Bum, I'll drive you." Still makes me smile. So at their invitation, Janice and I went to visit Coach Phillips at his ranch. As we pulled in, four dogs rushed out of the house and ran up to the car. Debbie invited us in and told us that Bum was out riding on his tractor. "That man loves his tractor more than me," she said. I was looking around in Bum's somewhat small, typical country house when Debbie asked to be excused for a minute. She went away and came back to find me looking at football stuff. "Looking for football paraphernalia?" she asked. I gave her a "yes, ma'am" in response. She said, "Well, Bum has given it all away for fundraisers, and it's all gone." Then Coach Phillips walked into the house with a big smile. Tractor rides did it for him. Janice, Debbie, and I went outside with Coach Phillips to their covered indoor arena. His ranch hand was trying to put a new leveling dragger on Bum's tractor. Debbie was giving instructions, but he ignored her. Finally, she had enough and couldn't hold back. "You think women are dumb?" she said, intense but under control. "Get out of my way, and I'll show both you and Bum how to put this thing on." Like that, she hooked it up, which took some real know-how. Yep, Debbie is a real country lady. Later on, we had lunch in Goliad at the little cafe on the square. People passed by saying howdy to Bum and Debbie. We picked up some feed at the local feed store, and that afternoon went to their round horse pen, where Debbie was showing a girl how to train her cutting horse. Bum was proud to tell us that he and a friend had built the horse pen. What a perfect Texas setting it was on that warm spring afternoon. We sat on the upper stands above that arena, watching those muscled, athletic horses do their magic, cutting out one cow and keeping her from going back to the herd. What a sheer joy for me and my small-town, horse-loving wife, Janice. I looked over at Bum, sitting there with his arms folded. From the hat to the boots, he was a portrait of perfect contentment. I just had to say, "Coach, you sure look happy." He looked back at me and said, "Tommy boy, who wouldn't be? Everything I love and need is right here." He looked out with those satisfied eyes, gazing at his surroundings. It was one of those moments you think, God's in his heaven and all's right with the world. One more Bum Phillips story, co-starring Pastor Chuck Swindoll. Several years later, at a Coach's Outreach Saturday night banquet, after Coach Phillips spoke, he mentioned to me how much he loved hearing Chuck Swindoll on radio and really wanted to visit his church. He was kind of insistent about it in his friendly way. So the next day, I drove us out to Stonebriar Community Church in North Dallas. Since I had worked for Chuck when he was president of Dallas Theological Seminary, I looked forward to seeing him again. I knew Chuck had a habit of greeting as many people as he could before church started, so we got there early. We waited in line, and then Chuck turned to see Coach Phillips. This is one football-loving pastor, and his eyes lit up with excitement to see Bum Phillips right there standing in line. Chuck reached out and heartily shook hands with Bum. Then he exclaimed, as if reaching the final point in a sermon, "You are my coach, Bum Phillips." I should explain, Chuck Swindoll was from Houston, so he really felt like Bum was his coach. But this nationally known pastor was still standing there in disbelief. He asked, still smiling, "So, Bum, what brings you here to Stonebriar?" Chuck was so excited. It was fun to watch. "Come to hear you preach," Bum answered. "I listen to you on the radio." Simple as that. After we had found our seats and settled in, Chuck stepped into the pulpit. He introduced Bum's presence in the service by saying, "You know, I'm no respecter of persons. If the President of the United States showed up at our church, I would not introduce him. I would treat him like any other person, which he is. But today, someone is here, someone very important, right here at Stonebriar Community Church. My coach, Bum Phillips, is our special guest today." Only Chuck Swindoll, who many call America's pastor, could pull that off. Chuck got into his sermon. I looked at Bum sitting next to me, smiling, enjoying Chuck's voice in person and the message, all happening right there in front of him, not just on radio. He was wearing that same look of perfect contentment I saw in his face when we visited his ranch. I thought, this is why he is a beloved Texas coach and means so much to so many people. I truly miss Coach Phillips, and having that day at the Phillips Ranch is a very special memory. Home life. God's providence was at work when, in the off-season of 1974, January through June, we purchased our first home in Bryan, Texas. It was a picture-perfect traditional home. We loved it. It even had a pool. We became super involved at the First Baptist Church in Bryan and became even closer to our pastor and his wife, Bailey and Joyce Stone. We were also good friends with Charlie and Doy McDaniel and David and Melina Schellenberger. Our daughters, Lauren and Leslie, were just 2 and 4 when we moved there. Lauren had been born the previous year while we were living in Houston. She loved excitement and fun, just like her dad. She changed her clothes at least 10 times a day and then checked the mirror to see how she looked in various outfits. Some of them were from Mama's closet, but size made no difference. She kept us laughing. Lauren was really kind of quiet and didn't talk much. Janice was teaching Leslie Bible verses, and Lauren, at around 3 years old, would just listen. One day, Leslie tried to recite a rather long verse. Lauren jumped in and gave us the whole verse. We couldn't believe it. Miss Very Quiet was listening, just not talking. I remember snuggling up with the girls on my lap on Saturday mornings, watching cartoons on TV. In our back den was a gas stove and my oversized foam chair, which was the perfect snuggle place. After cartoons, we would go to a local park and do all the activities from swinging to climbing the monkey bars. That was when we started the tradition of donuts on Saturday mornings, which both of the girls have carried into their families to this day. One thing's for sure about life, it's always changing. Although this was a happy time in our lives, things were about to change. I was about to transition out of football and into the next season the Lord had for us. Chapter 11, Life After Football, Lost Pup. After being cut by the Oilers in 1974, I felt like a lost pup. I received calls from a couple of pro teams, and since the World Football League was starting up, I received a couple of calls from coaches and team management. I also got a call from Jack Take Your Head Off Pardee, who was now head coach of a new World League team. They lost interest when I told them what I needed salary-wise. $28,000 was too much back then. I would have loved playing for Coach Pardee. He went on to be a great coach. His players had huge respect for him, if he didn't knock their head off their bodies. Just kidding. The truth is, God had other plans. There was an older gentleman from our church in Bryan who was a retired seminary professor. I really appreciated this man and the interest he took in me. Again, God brought a Bible coach to spur me along. He taught Greek in seminary and would later help me learn the Greek alphabet. I decided to take him to an A&M game, and helping him make his way up the steps, we got to our seats and settled in for the game. Well, a man named Bob Walker was sitting nearby. He happened to ask someone who I was. The next week, I received a call from Bob, and he asked if I would come to his office at Texas A&M. I don't remember if he told me his position or the reason he wanted to talk, but I said yes. Since I had lost my desire to play any more pro ball, I'd been praying for God to point me in a new direction. I'd heard from other veterans that I would know when it was time to retire, and I had a strong sense it was my time. For one thing, I had a bad injury that left my neck in a vulnerable position, with bone spurs that could lead to paralysis. That was our team doctor's report, and it helped to explain the tingling I had in my fingers. A second thing was the whole defensive back situation that continued to wear on me. I didn't like being average at that, and on top of that, it was hard to face the fact that I would likely never be a starter. So I remember meeting Bob Walker and thinking, this guy is really warm and friendly. I felt a connection to him right away. As I would learn, that was part of what made him such a great development man, fundraiser. And there we sat in his office, making chit-chat and then getting to why he wanted to talk to me. He said he'd watched me handle the older gentleman at the football game, and that prompted him to find out more about me. He explained his work for A&M and told me about his search for a field rep who could go and talk with Aggies, many of whom would be older gentlemen, discussing different scholarships to which they could contribute. He saw how I cared for the man at the game and knew I had a heart and respect for older men, which I always have had for some reason. Bob explained that my position would not be a high-pressure deal-maker, but more like relationship building with an opportunity presented rather than a direct ask for money. Well, I felt I could learn a lot from Bob Walker, and I did. He loved people and also loved to raise money for a great cause. We hit it off, and after talking it over with Janice, it seemed a good fit for me. Did God put me at that football game, prompting Bob Walker to ask about me? If you believe that there are no coincidences, as I do, then you see all of this as part of God's sovereign plan. The insights that Bob taught me were exactly what I needed to start Coach's Outreach. God was either in control of all this or he was not. He was, and he is. Blessed in Bryan. Our 4 years living in Bryan were fun and productive, a real blessing. We loved our church and Pastor Bailey Stone and his wife Joyce. R.C. Slocum was an assistant football coach at A&M, then later head football coach there. Bailey would come out and run pass patterns while I covered him, and R.C. threw him passes. R.C. also went to Bailey's church, and we both loved our pastor. Bailey would try and put some moves on me, hoping to fake me out. He looked so funny trying that, R.C. and I would crack up. We kidded him not to leave his day job as a preacher. God put Bailey in my life. He was fun, but his passion and love for a sovereign God were so real. He took time to meet with about five of us young guys in the church. He took us through a special discipleship course where we could ask questions and talk about the basics of the Christian faith. Bailey was God's man in my life, and the group interaction was so edifying and stimulating, just what I needed. We had a real close group of friends in Bryan College Station. We learned what life with small children was all about. We had a nice home with a pool and loved all our friends coming over, swimming and barbecuing all the time. Janice and I both have warm memories of these special friends. One of the friends, David Schellenberger, had a connection with Don Anderson, a traveling Bible teacher. Don would teach several times each week at homes and hotels in different towns. David invited him to come teach our group of friends, and later Don stayed at our house when he came to Bryan. Our study grew to around 15 couples, and if you do the math, that's 30 people. So we asked a local hotel, and they let us meet in a large conference room. This definitely was the Lord's work, causing these important connections to occur. Men plan, but God directs all plans. As the Word of God says, the heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. Proverbs 16:9. Here's the thing about Don Anderson. He loved teaching the Bible and could make it come alive like Prof. Smith. Don came into my life when I hungered for a deeper understanding of Scripture. Also at that time, I had a Bible study with some football players at A&M. Don and I, now friends, would sometimes go jogging at the college. That's when I started asking him, "Where did you go to seminary? Why? What did you learn?" Yep, I asked a lot of questions. Don met me once in Dallas when he arranged a meeting with two professors at Dallas Theological Seminary, Dr. Howard Hendricks and Dr. Don Campbell. I really liked them both. Little did I know that they were both legends in the Christian faith and would help to clarify and strengthen my foundational understanding of Scripture. Planting the seed for seminary. I suppose my desire to go to seminary started back when I played with the Baltimore Colts from 1969 to 1970. The Colts had a Friday night Bible study with Captain Bill Lewis, former Navy veteran, who lived close to Annapolis, Maryland, and the Naval Academy. That was about 50 miles from Baltimore, and he made the drive to meet with us on Friday nights. Friday night was normally party night in pro football because preparations were over, and Saturdays we would travel to away games or check into a local hotel about 6 p.m. for short meetings and bed checks. Captain Bill was a really interesting Bible teacher, and that was the first time I'd really looked around in the Bible. You know, there are certain books and passages you tend to go to, but you know other books and other places deserve your attention. Thanks to Bill Lewis, I took a wider look into God's Word. With Captain Bill, it was like diving into an ocean of discovery. When I was traded to the Oakland Raiders, I really didn't have the Bible teaching or mentoring I had with the Colts. Bob Vogel, all-pro lineman with the Colts, was a great mentor. He took me with him when he spoke to Christian organizations and challenged me to start asking God to use me the same way. A common saying in football when you were getting ready to face a tough opposing team was, "You better button your chin strap." Well, when you ask God to use you, and you mean it, you better button your chin strap. The more I spoke to people, the hungrier I became to understand the Bible better. That desire grew, and when I finished my career in football, we settled in Bryan College Station, the home of my alma mater, Texas A&M. That's when we rejoined the Baptist Church there, since, as I said, Janice and I loved Pastor Bailey Stone and his wife Joyce. Janice attended a study Joyce led for young wives. About five young guys asked Bailey if he would meet with us every week to talk about issues like prayer, Bible verse memory, witnessing, etc. We were all hungry to better understand what the Lord had for us. His teaching was very practical, and the five or six guys involved have all gone on to serve Christ in different ways. As a result of all the ways God has used the men from that group, I'm sure Bailey has received heavenly rewards he never imagined. Bailey shares in the same rewards we do. That's how discipleship works in God's kingdom. And what you have heard from me, in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. 2 Timothy 2:2. Timothy spent many years in close association with the Apostle Paul. He heard divine truth that God had revealed to Paul, who revealed that truth to many other faithful believers, Silas, Barnabas, Luke, etc. Every Christian should be sharing with passion how the truth of God has strengthened their lives. Hey, that's why I wrote this book. So as a result of interaction with these Bible teachers and my visit to Dallas Theological Seminary with Don Anderson, God began planting something, like a seed, ready to sprout. But still, I wasn't sure if I should attend DTS or another seminary. After more conversations and after seeking God's will, I made my choice. Chapter 12, Seminary, A New Experience, Fish Out of Water. In the fall of 1978, I became a student at Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, this was a whole new experience. Maxwell, the fish out of water. I had never studied so hard. There were constant argument papers you had to write, dealing with the problem passages in the Bible. My sweet wife would stay up long after the girls had gone to sleep, typing papers for me. That was after Janice spent all day working as a speech pathologist. Then there were Greek and Hebrew classes, because, as you may know, the Bible was originally written in Greek and Hebrew. At Dallas Seminary back in the 70s, you had to take 3 years of Greek and 2 years of Hebrew. Dallas Seminary is the only four-year seminary. Others were three. That's because DTS emphasizes understanding biblical languages. I majored in Old Testament, OT, so I had to take extra Hebrew courses. One of them was called Rapid Hebrew Reading. That title kept me up at night. The fish really wanted to jump back into the water. But I chose the OT major for a reason. I liked reading the Old Testament and really wanted to understand it better. So after meeting with a professor who guided new students and their studies, I picked Old Testament as my major. Most of the OT students in that rapid Hebrew reading course were studying to be seminary professors, teaching Hebrew or OT studies, so it was required for them. But there I was, a former defensive back from the NFL. The professor would put Hebrew verbs on the board, and he would ask one of us to parse the verb. So embarrassing for me. I would jokingly ask for hints just to relieve some pressure. Prof couldn't help but smile. I'd hear a giggle or two from some of the students. I often felt like standing up and saying, "Any of you Hebrew nerds think you could cover Bob Hayes of the Dallas Cowboys? Huh? Do you? Huh?" Then there were the Greek classes. Same thing. The professor would put Greek words on the board and ask a student to parse them. I didn't know that word until seminary. Parse means to divide, for example, a sentence into its different parts and explain how the parts relate to each other. Then he would also talk about a passage of scripture in Greek and point out the importance of knowing the original language to have a clear meaning of the text. I love that part. One time, the prof was going into great detail in the Greek. He stopped and asked if there were any questions. A student named Reese Lester, good old country boy from Georgia, raised his hand. The professor, Dr. Zane Hodges, said, "Yes, Mr. Reese, may I help you?" Reese then said, "Well, Dr. Hodges, I haven't understood a thing you've said for the last 10 minutes. Everyone had a chuckle. Then Professor Zane Hodges apologized laughingly when a funny look came on his face. He looked down at his student list and said, "Oh my, your last name is Lester, and I have been calling you Mr. Reese." Then, without missing a beat, Mr. Reese said, "Oh, that's okay, Mr. Zane." We all had a laugh over that. I had been wanting to meet Reese, so after class I introduced myself. I told him that he seemed to be struggling in class like me. I told him how I couldn't understand how so many of the students already knew so much about Greek. Reese said he went to see Professor Hodges and asked him the same question. He found out that many students had gone to Bible colleges and studied Greek there. Neither one of us had ever heard of a Bible college, so that exchange with Reese made me feel a little better. Maybe the fish was learning to breathe the air. Reese became a beloved pastor and will be missed by many as he went to be with the Lord recently. I could go into great detail on the grind of seminary, but it was also fascinating. Greek and Hebrew were very interesting at times, but my favorite courses were church history and the Bible courses where professors would teach through the Bible, about 3 months on several books, like Genesis through Leviticus, pretty much verse by verse. I really feel like a blessed man having had the opportunity to experience these in-depth biblical studies. Your faith grows and grows as you see how practical the Bible is for us down-to-earth human beings. Our Creator wants His people to live a completely full life. God has always desired a close personal relationship with His creation, and that becomes so clear as you look deeply into the Scripture, especially as you see the sacrifice God's own Son was willing to go through. And that close relationship is always there for someone who has experienced God's forgiveness. That is, to believe that God's Son, Jesus Christ, died on a cross, taking upon His perfect, sinless body God's judgment for our sins. God should have sent all people to hell because of their sinful nature, but He offered redemption through faith in Christ, knowing that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23. Seminary gave me a heavy dose of God's truth. God's forgiveness and grace grew more and more captivating. My faith grew more and more inspired. My peace and understanding of life grew more informed and secure. All of that to educate, support, and encourage me to some kind of full-time ministry, even though every believer who reads his Bible will experience the same. So there you have it, my seminary career in a nutshell. Football, seminary style. So now I was a holy man, all involved in seminary. Stop giggling. I hoped my thoughts would be pure and my words would always be encouraging. Then along came an independent seminary from California, Talbot Seminary, a darn good seminary by reputation. through certain people, Dallas Theological Seminary, DTS, received a challenge from Talbot to a flag football game. They would come to Dallas and play us. Willing to go that far and spend that kind of money for a flag football game. Well, the sport competition gene went to work in the minds of old ex-jocks, as you might say. We had some good former football players at DTS. The word got around and a meeting was held. It was a short meeting. Where do we play and when? This would be a good break from studies. Actually, this Talbot bunch didn't give us much time. They were coming in about 2 weeks. And after a little research, we found out that this team was big time in California and won most of their games. The day arrived and the game was on. It wasn't a sold-out crowd, our wives and a few students, but Dr. John Walvoord, president of DTS, was fired up as a former football player himself, Wheaton College, Illinois. I'm not sure what he expected. For one thing, we only had time to practice once. That was bad. But there was a bigger problem. None of us, that's right, none of us, had ever played flag football. The moment arrived and we ran onto the field in our makeshift uniforms. We were a ragtag army. Some DTS t-shirts from the seminary bookstore, normal shorts, and a few Bermudas. But we were greeted by a slick-looking ball club in nice matching shorts and tops. Well, we thought, here we go. We kicked off first, and here they came. They moved the ball, passing and running. We had some big, tough studs, but that doesn't count in flag football. Speed, agility, and passing get the job done. I'll never forget this one guy. We'll call him Cowboy, who was one of our 8 starters, only 10 on the team. Seems like he was in on every play, but not in a good way. See, in flag football, you stop a runner by pulling one of 2 flags snapped to a kind of belt around his waist. Ends, running backs, QB, etc. Well, Cowboy had a hard time grabbing the flag, a learned skill, so he would simply grab the runner somewhere, anywhere, and hold him long enough to pull the flag. That became a 10-yard penalty on us every time. So Talbot players came quickly down the field, shall we say. We thought after each of about 5 penalties, he would catch on. He didn't, and there they were, on the 10-yard line, about to score on their first drive. Next, we forgot we were representing Dallas Theological Seminary, the Harvard of seminaries, as we like to say. I mean, you'd think a seminary would be where future Christian workers, pastors, and teachers were trained, and you'd think we'd have been aware of our wives, other students, their wives, profs, and even Dr. Walvoord in the stands. But no, we were not. In fact, the song, "The Heat Is On," comes to mind as I try to describe what happened next. We turned into fire-breathing, dragon-mad, righteously angry players. Someone told Cowboy to stop grabbing the runners. That comment did not help Cowboy's attitude. He looked at the accuser and answered as if he were carefully translating a word from the Greek, "I'm not grabbing, I'm tackling. And if they come my way, I'm not going to let them spin around and dance their way into the end zone. Understand?" I guess we did, and then it happened. Those Talbot boys were no dummies. They knew how to quickly pick up penalty yards by now. They ran to Cowboy's side, and he flew into action, putting what is known in football as a form tackle on the running back, forehead to the chest, and no helmet. He then grabbed and pulled both legs forward, landing the runner on his back, and came down on him with his head still in his chest. This halfback may have been smaller, but he forgot that he was representing Talbot Seminary, and he came up swinging. Oh, what a scene. These soon-to-be preachers were swinging fists and knocking jaws. A few, not many, cooler heads came to the rescue before too much bloodshed stained the seminary field. I can see it all like it happened yesterday. What a mess. The next day, some of the holier-than-thou egghead students made sarcastic comments like, "Nice fight last night." After much of that, too much of that, I told one of them, "How about a nice fight right now?" Well, in case you're wondering, we won the game by 1 point. Not much handshaking afterwards as we departed the field. I'm not sure if the moon was out and the stars were shining. I was too busy getting out of there. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Not So Fast by Tommy Maxwell and Rod Butler. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.